This is Red by Walk and Talk. Read by 15. Chapter 1. Crash. Jim was bone-burning tired. It was almost first sundown, and he'd finally finished the northern field. He jumped off the harvester, gratified that Bones was standing on the porch waiting with a plate of food for him. Jim didn't even bother taking it to the table, just sunk to the steps of the old porch and dug into the vegetable stew and bread. He finished it in moments and accepted a second plate and glass of sweetened water with a grunt of appreciation. "Cool today," the doctor said, leaning up against the porch post. Jim nodded. "Good." It bode well and made harvesting easier. It wouldn't stay that way for much longer. "I can get most of the east field done by second sun." "The east field will have to wait. The teacher contacted me. His shuttle overshot to the other side of Sandy Ridge, and he'll need help navigating back to the settlement." Jim startled. Nothing waited for harvest. They were one man down on their tiny homestead, leaving all heavy labor to Jim. The weather was a gift that couldn't be squandered. "Surely one of the settlement kids could," Jim started, but Bones shook his head. Either they were too young or married off. It had to be Jim. Bones leaned heavily on his crutch, his face full of understanding. "Can't be helped, Jim. If you start now, you'll be home before moon up." Jim chewed silently, tamping down his dismay at being so inconvenienced. One helped one's neighbor. One did not rebel against the trials one was given. One took up all work joyfully. Damn it. Spock stood on the ridge, looking down into a small ravine, and attempted to collect geological data with his tricorder. His brow furrowed in confusion as he read the screen.
"Those won't work here,"
a voice called from behind his left shoulder. He spun around to see a young human, certain it was his guide from the colony on Luddy 4 making his way toward Spock and his damaged shuttle. He shut the tricorder and made his way back from the ridge. Spock and the man met at the destroyed shuttle's doors. From this distance, he could ascertain that his rescuer was a bit younger than his own 26 years, dressed in plain clothes and a rust-colored cotton shirt with the sleeves rolled to the elbows. His felt hat covered sun-bleached hair that fell around his ears, and he wore sturdy work boots. "Red scrambles everything," the man said, gesturing to Spock's hip where his tricorder rested. "That's why you're getting haywire readings. I bet it sent your shuttle into a tizzy." Spock agreed silently. What should have been a standard computer-managed landing was very quickly turned into a near-death experience. "Red?" "The planet. Luddy 4. We call it Red." The man gestured vaguely at the shady surroundings, for obvious reasons. Upon exiting his shuttle after the crash landing, the landscape recalled that of the Appalachian Range of Earth, a place Spock visited on a camping excursion he had taken as a child, although the soil here was tinged with muddy red, as were the leaves of most of the trees. The river that ran through the ravine he was observing sparkled on the edges, with a garnet shimmer along the banks. Spock found himself surveying the immense oak-like tree beside him, its bark a brilliant gold, licked with red streaks. "I was aware there were geological anomalies, but I will have to study this further," Spock conceded aloud. The human nodded tentatively, as if unsure what Spock meant by his comment. "I'm Jim," he said, breaking their brief, awkward silence. "Lieutenant Spock." I have several cases of science equipment that will need to be transported at the earliest convenience. Jim glanced over his shoulder, where several containers were stacked neatly inside the damaged shuttle, and made a low whistle. I'm afraid we'll be short on convenient times for a while, teacher. You've come in the middle of harvest. I'm to take you back to the mission house, and we can see about the equipment. It's a hard hike back, so it's best we carry smart. Spock nodded, anticipating as much. He lifted the small satchel he had packed for himself, and Jim nodded approvingly. They started the walk back together without comment. It was not an uncomfortable walk. As soon as Jim appeared to recognize Spock's stamina and strength, they kept up a quick pace, and Jim supplied anecdotes and answered questions about Red and the settlement not found in the database. When Spock was first assigned to the small settlement in the Luddy system, he had read all the literature on the planet. Previously uninhabited Class M planet. Settlement population, 412 beings, 94% human. Agrarian society. The planet was marked for colonization and secured by Enid Winter Perez, and the first wave of colonists broke ground 17 years ago. Winter Perez and her followers called themselves Azunites, after Pablo Azuni, moderately infamous for his role in the anti-android movement of 2088. 10 years ago, Winter Perez's colony opened their borders in response to the OSD, taking 11 survivors. Spock had read everything from Winter Perez, from her undergraduate essays on post-first contact ethics to her speech on the death of humanity she made just before her death 2 years ago.
We don't have tricorders. Not that it would matter, Jim commented, pointing to the fungus that ran along the sides of the trees near the ravine they followed. That's what you need to look for, the green creepers. They'll show you where potable water is. Only when they're flush and green. The red ones are a slow death. After 3 hours, they broke through the tree line onto fields of dusky red grains. This is the Sulu farm, Jim explained, waving a hand high to a large mechanical harvester. Spock had never seen anything like the noisy machinery slowly making its way across the field. The farmer operating it waved back. Their property is adjacent to the mission's property. We're not far. They continued on a worn path along the fields where Jim answered questions about red grain, its life cycle, and uses. As they made it to a small crossroads, Spock heard the rustling and thumping of footsteps.
Jim!
A small girl cried, bursting out of the shoulder-tall grass.
Jim, wait for me!
Zippy, what are you doing in the fields? Jim asked, allowing the young girl to swing off of his arms for a moment before depositing her back on the ground. She wore a nearly identical outfit to Jim's, save her being barefoot and hair in long dark braids. The young human girl, no more than 7, furtively glanced up at Spock.
I thought you needed my help.
You mean you wanted to see teacher, Jim said knowingly. Zippy blushed.
Teacher, this is Zipporah Sulu, your youngest pupil.
Spock felt at ill ease in the presence of such a young student, but nodded in polite acknowledgement. Jim crouched at her level, tugging a braid.
I am thankful for the help, but my tasks have been productive thus far. I would not want to prevent your own achievements today.
Zippy blushed again, squeaked a small goodbye to Jim and teacher, and ran off, this time along the road back to the Sulu house. There's 10 Sulu kids, Jim said as they started walking again. But only 6 of them will be in school, so you're lucky there. The last teacher had 9 Sulus at once. Spock squinted up at the narrow home at the end of the lane, imagining 10 children raised there.
Are you in school?
Jim scoffed.
Me?
No, I finished. Bones mostly taught me. I mean, Dr. Leonard McCoy. He's what we have for a... Yes, I'm aware of Dr. McCoy's work.
Jim blinked. Oh, yeah? Spock ignored the poorly worded question. Who lives at the mission?
Just me and Bones, and now you. We had more, but they grew up.
Sometimes the kids from the outer homesteads will winter here for school, but I don't know if they're sending any this year.
Haven't heard, but we'll know after harvest.
Jim smiled, brightening. You'll be here for the harvest festival. We've never had a teacher come so early and be able to stay for the festival. Should be educational.
Typical agrarian celebration, Spock assumed.
They passed in companionable silence for 2 more miles until Jim pointed off in the distance between 2 hills. Spock could barely make out the 2-story building, its white roof gleaming dusky pink in the setting sun.
We're home.
As they walked through the fields of red grain, the suns were starting to set.
It's a 4-hour night, Jim had warned him. It takes some getting used to.
You were not born here, Spock inferred. Jim nodded his head.
I came when I was 10. It took me a while to adjust to something dirtside, and the nights threw me off. Bones called it sun sickness. Took me months to get over it.
Vulcans only sleep for 5 hours.
Jim looked over to him, both impressed and curious.
I've never met a Vulcan before.
I am half Vulcan, he admitted. My mother is human.
Jim did not appear surprised by the unusual admission.
People here are going to be mistrustful of anything Starfleet, Jim cautioned. I wouldn't take it personally.
I do not.
As they approached, a man hobbled out of the residence, leaning on a crutch. Jim grabbed his hat and started to wave it.
Bones crushed his leg in a harvest accident, Jim shared. He's homebound for the next few weeks. It's making him cranky, so don't take it personally. Although, to be honest, Jim rubbed the back of his neck when he replaced his hat. He's always a little cranky.
I will still not take it personally.
Jim grinned.
When they reached the path, Jim made a wide formal gesture toward the man leaning heavily against a garden fence.
Teacher, this is Dr. McCoy.
Bones, meet teacher.
The doctor, known to be in his late 30s, looked older.
His eyes, a few shades darker than Jim's brilliant blue, peered out over sun-worn brown that hadn't seen a sterile laboratory in years.
Lieutenant Spock, welcome to RID.
We're mighty glad you landed in one piece.
Landed may be an incorrect term, Spock admitted.
Jim snickered.
However, most of the equipment is undamaged.
Good fortune, the doctor said.
Jim, let's help our guests get settled in the bunkhouse.
Jim made a strange face.
But we've got...
You'll have to fetch the sheets from the upstairs cupboard, McCoy interrupted, barring no argument.
Jim's face fell, but he ambled up the stairs into the mission house.
McCoy looked over Spock for a long moment.
You're younger than the others, he observed.
Spock didn't comment.
When they said they were sending a Vulcan, I expected someone a bit...
He could see why Jim was so concerned he would take the doctor's words personally.
Yes.
Less like you are. McCoy started to hobble toward the porch stairs, passing Spock and making his way to a small garden.
That's not necessarily a bad thing.
Perhaps you'll outlast your predecessor.
This way, Lieutenant.
McCoy escorted him to another white wooden building, a simple one-story with pane windows and a large covered porch with a lean-to, a single bench, and several dusty barrels.
The boys used to live here, McCoy said.
Should be comfortable enough for you. Your own space for your equipment and such.
It was more than was promised in the installation agreement with Starfleet, and Spock said so.
If one has, one gives, joyfully, McCoy said, quoting something Spock was unfamiliar with.
He opened the door. No locks, mechanical or otherwise, Spock noted. to show him a large, serviceable area with two bunk beds, chairs, a table, and a simple chest of drawers. The doctor pointed to the heater in the corner. "Fueled by red rock, so you'll want to keep a supply of it. Nights are short, but cold." Jim appeared in the doorway, arms full of linens and a pillow. "You'll be okay out here?" He took three long strides and dropped the linens onto the bottom of the far bunk bed. "There's a shower in the lean-to, but all the water is hand-pumped out here." "It is more than sufficient," Spock decided, already planning where his lab equipment would be. Jim grinned, shoving his hands in his pockets. "Supper," McCoy announced, and hobbled his way back through the vegetable garden to the mission house, leaving Jim and Spock to trail behind him. Jim pointed out what was planted, what would be harvested this season, and Spock shared a bit of his own knowledge of herbs and Terran vegetables he had learned from his mother, who kept a small garden on Vulcan. Gardening and harvesting maintained their conversation through dinner, which was a simple meal of nutty purple bread and cheese. Tastes just like mozzarella, but it's pink, so I can't wrap my mind around it. Throughout, McCoy was quiet, contemplatively so. When their meal was done, McCoy let Jim clear the table as Spock and he sat out on the front porch, cooler breezes starting to pick up. The doctor started to whittle something, surgeon's fingers deftly forming shape out of wood. "After harvest, we can spare the people to help bring your equipment back to the mission house. Until then, it's just us and our simple life." Spock nodded. "I will attempt not to trouble you beyond what was outlined in the agreement." "I hope so." That night, when Spock had loaded the stove with red rock and dressed in his regulation sleepwear, which was woefully inadequate for the sharply bitter night, he slipped into his bottom bunk and looked up to see something scratched into the wood of the bunk above. He reached out, tracing the words in the darkness. Jim was here. End of chapter 1. Author's notes. Gentle readers, I've had this story in my head for a while, affectionately referred to as Space Amish, but based roughly off of some post-war Luddite-like movement. I hope you enjoy. This is Red. Chapter 2. Land.
"It's how they do things here, teacher," Jim called out for the sixth time that day, dropping his tools into the bag Spock was holding after they adjusted the cylinder speed on the combine. He wiped his greasy hands across the front of his dark coveralls. "I would have volunteered to do a different job had I realized my skills with your harvester was inconsequential." "It's all simple machines," Jim pointed out cheerfully, donning his felt hat again. "Basic mechanics, something you learned in Vulcan nursery school, I bet." Spock nodded, although that fact did not mean his education easily translated to what was necessary on Red. His first few days he had done whatever was asked of him, which kept him busy from morning to night. Most days he carried out simple menial tasks given by Dr. McCoy or followed Jim around the farm. On the third day, McCoy had declared Spock was a fine example of Vulcan industriousness, which, judging by Jim's expression, was high praise from the gruff doctor. He then launched into a long and winding explanation of the parallels to Azunite philosophy and Serakian logic. How things were done on Red did not make much logical sense, but Spock kept his opinions to himself. They did not use basic sanitation protocols for water. There was not a single sonic diffuser on the planet. They did not use an osteocompound to heal Dr. McCoy's broken leg in minutes, as the doctor was surely used to when he was a director of a modern medical facility on Earth. They had no relay communication, although Jim insisted they could contact the Sulu or Cheko farms quickly if they needed to. "It's how they do things," Jim would say. "They, not us. as if Jim stood apart in some indefinable way. After second meal, I'll show you how we... Jim paused, then lifted a finger to his lips to quiet Spock. He turned his head as if hearing something in the distance. Spock heard it too, but hadn't recognized it. Birds chirping. Red didn't have birds. "It's Ben," Jim said, standing up and brushing the red dust off his pants. "He's coming for second meal." Jim lifted his fingers to his mouth and started to trill a series of complicated whistles. Four notes rang clearly over the field, making Jim grin. "He's bringing Zippy." "The whistling," Spock started, understanding not forthcoming. "Old language, adapted from Greece. You'd have to learn it the old-fashioned way, I think, because there's no universal translator setting for it. Not that they use UTs here." Jim hoisted himself up on the harvester, offering a handout to Spock, who declined for reasons of Vulcan modesty, not that Jim would be aware of that faux pas. "I think we'll finish today," Jim commented as he started the harvester. Spock wedged uncomfortably into his side. Jim hitched his arm behind him, giving Spock's shoulders more room. "Finished?" Spock was eagerly looking forward to the inevitable end of harvesting, so that he could then retrieve his supplies at the abandoned shuttle. "We are never finished," Jim admitted. "With all seasons of joyful life, there is work." Another Azonite quote, Spock assumed. Perhaps he needed to start reading McCoy's library if he was to carry on a conversation with his hosts. When they brought the harvester back and deposited its precious grain, hooked the harvester in its solar charging station, checked on Bluebell the nanny goat, still hadn't kitted, and washed up, Dr. McCoy was already sitting on the porch with a young man with dark hair and an easy smile. 7-year-old Zippy was sprawled out on the steps, but leapt to her feet as soon as she spotted Jim and Spock. "There they are," McCoy called, good-natured. "How was the morning?" "Southern field is finished," Jim said, bounding up the stairs beside Zippy, tweaking her braids. "Hello, Ben. Good to see you." "A season to be thankful for," the man said, standing up. "I've come to offer my help." Jim grinned, slapping Ben on the back. "Oh, I see. Running away from your new home. Zippy, are you running him down to the bone out there?" Ben elbowed Jim back. "The old man can't keep an eye on you like I can," he shot back, quickly glancing at Spock. Jim's ears pinked. "I'm limping, not hard of hearing," McCoy said, taking his crutch and swinging it threateningly. Ben and Jim laughed. "Straighten up. You want to make a good impression on teacher." Ben's attention hadn't really left Spock, but simply sharpened. "We're grateful you're here, teacher. I'm Ben Sulu, and my sister-in-law, Zippy." He gestured to the girl, who was staring at Spock avidly. "I heard your arrival was a bit more perilous than your average shuttle landing." Spock nodded. "Although the most important cargo is undamaged and secure, thankfully." "That's why I've come, to offer my help transporting it," Ben said, eyeing the doctor more than Spock, waiting for his approval. Dr. McCoy nodded. "Glad to hear things are going so well with Iko's harvest, with all the new responsibilities of a bigger herd." "Oh, you know Sulus. They're just prodigious multipliers," Jim teased. Ben casually kicked Jim in the shin, making him wince a bit. "Boys," McCoy sighed. "Miss Zipporah, what was today made for?" "To share in joy and work, so that tomorrow we may do the same," Zippy recited, taking McCoy's offered hand as he limped into the house. "Then let us share in a meal," he announced, and the others followed. They gathered around the table, Jim and Ben squeezing together amicably on the low bench with Zippy, while McCoy and Spock got chairs to themselves. Second meal was always the largest, this time cooked quinoa and zucchini, roasted chickpeas, flatbread, and the berries Zippy had picked on the way to the mission. Ben offered 20 minutes of nonstop news, peppered with Zippy's comments. Who had lost sheep in the last storm? How the newest potato crop venture had fared? If Nana Wendell's heart medication was taken consistently? Spock gathered that Ben used to live at the mission with Jim, but had left to become the husband of Hikaru Sulu, one of the aforementioned 9 Sulu children and Zippy's older brother. Hikaru had just started a project of tending a herd of barely domesticable native red boars. "They're monstrous, but sweet most of the time," Jim said. Ben snorted. "They need huge amounts of land to forage, so we suspect we don't really have all the resources they need to be productive on the farm," Ben explained.
"Hikaru and Ben want to move out," Zippy said.
"Zippy, hush. That's not for you to talk about," Ben scolded. He glanced reluctantly at Dr. McCoy.
"Is that true, Ben?"
The man squared his jaw. "Yes, sir."
"I see," the doctor said. "Jim, Zippy, why don't you go check on Bluebell?"
Without question, Jim and Zippy pushed back from the table, not making any eye contact with Spock, who felt a little lost.
"I imagine it's a little crowded at home. 10 Sulus and a baby on the way."
Ben nodded emphatically, but still awaited some sort of blow.
"You've thought about a homestead?"
"Hikaru wants to try south of the shale, but I'm not sure."
"You want to stay on Sulu land," McCoy inferred.
Ben shrugged.
"Hikaru wants to try more animal husbandry. He thinks the shale might be good."
"And this is you, asking my opinion?"
"Both of us, sir."
McCoy leaned back, considering the young man across the table.
"I say it is good."
The last syllable visibly diffusing the tension across Ben's shoulders.
"Hikaru is right. We need more work with the boars."
Ben nodded, quietly pleased, glancing up at Spock curiously.
"Time for you and teacher to get going, I suspect," McCoy said. "Jim can finish storing the grain, and I'll need Zippy to help me around here. If you and Ben start now, I imagine you can still be back by second sun."
The first order of business was to plan how many kilos of supplies would make its way back to the mission. Help came from an unlikely source. Ben led Spock back from whence he had come days prior, through the Sulu homestead, and introduced him to his husband's pet project, the red boars. Monstrous didn't describe the creatures accurately. Easily thousands of kilograms, they were the size of a Clydesdale, shoulder to shoulder with Spock, its girth enormous. Shaggy mahogany hair covered its body with 2 intelligent eyes peering out at them, with the fangs of a deep-sea anglerfish. 4 of them, 1 buck and 3 sows, had free rein of the woods that outlined the west side of the pasture, but currently enjoyed the shelter of a barn.
"This is Sully, the leader of the herd," Ben said, patting him on his flank.
"He'll be coming with us." Amazingly, Sully navigated the rocky terrain with surprising ease, with hooves the size of dinner plates, setting a comfortable pace with the occasional snacking, a travois rigged across his back. Ben was also an easy companion on the hike back to the shuttle. He was even chattier than Jim, but didn't expect Spock to participate, which suited them both fine. He learned that horses didn't do well on Red. Neither did chickens or any other Terran bird. Ben hypothesized the magnetic fields were too disruptive for them to flourish. Alpaca, sheep, and tellurite wixo provided most of the product for cloth. Most people kept a few goats for milk, and Hikaru had a desperate desire to try oyster farming in the saline lakes several kilometers away. Ben and Hikaru had married last harvest festival, which was a surprise to everyone who knew I was sweet on Eva Chekhov and didn't even give that dopey kid a second look,
And then, the next thing I know, he's still coming to school, but I left years ago, which is how we do things here, and he's still hanging around at the bunkhouse, bugging me and Jim. And then it wasn't bugging anymore, yeah? Spock nodded, but didn't quite follow. So just as I was thinking maybe I should ask his parents if we could start visiting formally, the way we do things, he asked McCoy permission to start courting me. Ben laughed, keeping the pace ahead of Sully. Like it was a done deal. Which it was to him, I guess. He said he knew what he wanted when he saw me, but he was willing to wait. We visited for a month, and then courted for three, and sat together at the community meeting just a week before the Harvest Festival. How do they do things on Vulcan? Very differently, he hedged, and Ben blithely picked up the reins of the conversation, this time on family life with the Sulus. There were 9 children. Juniper, Yui, and Hikaru had left school, and Spock would have the pleasure of teaching Mei, Akari, Sara, Hiroshi, Zipporah, and Kaito. At least 12 other families typically sent their children to school, although it depended on how well the harvest went, and what the general community feeling was about teacher. We've never had a Vulcan here, Ben said. Some people may not want to send their kids to school, but I wouldn't take it personally. Jim has advised similarly. Ben nodded, smiling. It took them years to warm up to me and Jim, so we would know. They're used to outside people wanting to change things to suit themselves. You're from the OSD, Spock said, finally feeling comfortable to speak what he had suspected since he met Jim. Ben nodded. The orphan ship disaster, one of the great diplomatic and humanitarian catastrophes since the Federation's inception. 8,000 colonists lived on newly established Tarsus IV, and in less than a year, less than 4,000 survived the blight and subsequent genocide executed by Governor Kodos. Less than 100 children survived. 72 were orphans. Those orphans were placed on the USS Quixote, which was later attacked by Klingon raiders defending the border near the Tarsus system. Only one crewman and a few children were recovered from the wreckage. 11 of us, Jim and I, were the youngest. Jim had to have been 12 at the most. They didn't trust us at first. Enid had the bunkhouse built, allowed the school, let the other families send their kids if they wanted. I'm not sure what she expected to happen. I was a mess, but Red grounded me, you know? I learned to share the work and eventually share the joy. Tarsus was about excess and power, but you can't create that on Red. It's hard living, but no one goes without. We will never needlessly starve. But hey, it's not for everyone, right? The oldest kids, Tommy and Lauren, they hopped the first starship they could and haven't heard from them since. 3 years ago, Callie did too. But the rest of us have integrated, married, and settled down. Except for Jim. Ben stopped, finally taking a breath. But Jim's different from the rest of us, yeah? Spock nodded, because he knew that Jim was different, but he didn't understand. Several hours later, they reached the bunkhouse, Sully laden with more advanced equipment than Red had since arrival day all those years ago. Ben and Jim helped Spock carry the cases in, setting them down in a chaotic pattern only Spock understood. When the last was in, Ben bid him farewell and headed home, Sully behind him. Jim stood in the middle of the room, eyeing the boxes curiously. "It's a lot of stuff," Jim commented, as Spock started to open the 2 largest cases, containing parts of an interphasic compensator. "Yes. I can explain, if you would like." The war across Jim's face was evident. "I would not want to keep you from your personal productive work. It would not be proper." "It's the way they do things here." Spock had been listening and learning.
I have lost many days to prepare for the school session, Spock admitted, pleased to see Jim light up a little, anticipating his next offer. I would value your assistance. I'd be happy to share in your work, Jim said, taking a tentative step towards one of the already opened cases. I am assembling the interphasic compensator along this wall, but if you can lay out the instruments in that case, I can organize them later. They worked in comfortable silence for many minutes, and when Spock looked over at Jim's work, he was momentarily speechless. You organized them already. Isolinear to duotronic, Jim said. I just assumed. It was more than that. He organized them like a surgeon's table, each tool and device spaced apart for the maximum ergonomic benefit. Excellent work. Thank you, teacher. Spock leveled a considering look at Jim, who turned pink under his gaze. What do you know about duolytic inverters?
End of chapter 2. Author's notes. Gentle readers, thank you for reading. Next chapter, Harvest Festival. Fermented grain water. Haystacks. Hot and bothered Vulcans. Looking forward to sharing with you soon. Walk and talk.